Why am I not surprised? No one here. Rachel and Brickle were seated in an unmarked car outside number 57, and once again there was no one answering the door, despite Rachel having left a voicemail for Michelle Harper telling her they'd like to speak to her again. You never know, she may have just popped out to the shop, suggested Brickle. Give her a minute or two. But Rachel was shaking her head. She reached for her phone and pulled up the photos that WPC Nichols had taken. What am I looking at? The wheelie bin, completely empty apart from a few bits of junk mail. So, the bin men had probably just been. She shook her head again. No, the bin men were just about to arrive. Come off it, Prince. She might not have got round to taking stuff out to the dustbin. We've all done it. Ah, but, Rachel grinned, I made sure I chucked a takeaway cup into the kitchen bin so I could get a good look inside it. It was empty. Brickle's expression was still blank. Come on, Detective Sergeant, if you're living somewhere, the kitchen bin is full of tea bags, eggshells, kitchen towel, food packaging. There was nothing. And what about the dog? The dog? She's supposed to have a dog, but there's been no sign of it on any of my visits. If she's not here, it's hardly surprising in the circumstances, Brickle said mulishly. She could have been staying with a relative or friend for a few weeks. God knows it must be hard enough for her being alone in that house. Maybe. Either way, we haven't got all day to sit about. We've got the Seop case conference this afternoon. You can't wait to get back up to Pimlico to see your hunky Denton. Rachel flicked her seatbelt buckle at him, as though swatting a fly. You're a cock, Brickle. Just as he was about to retaliate by balling up a sweet wrapper and flicking it at her, the familiar white BMW drove up and Michelle Harper climbed out. So how are we going to play this? Brickle asked before they got out of the car. We don't want to get her hopes up, nor do we want to spook her. Keep it low key. It's not like we can say we know for sure what's happened to Lola Jade. Not yet. Better do the same at this afternoon's case conference, affirmed Brickle with a wry grin. Can't swagger in there claiming we've cracked it when the kid's still missing. Michelle's body language had changed, Rachel thought. She'd dropped the bravado and the thinly veiled passive aggression, seeming listless, flat. The black leggings and plain top were unassuming, the makeup low-key. She's not dead, is she? Was the first thing out of her mouth, even though Rachel had given no indication on the phone that this was the case. No, Rachel shook her head, not as far as we know, but I did find your husband. Michelle's eyes widened. He was in Spain? No, said Rachel. Not in Spain, in Portugal. Portugal? Brickle glanced at Rachel, and she knew what that particular look of his meant, that the shock seemed a little overdone. He doesn't have Lola Jade with him. He's lying. The grieving mum mask slipped a little as she spat the words. Rachel shook her head. I don't think so, but he's now back in the UK, so we'll be able to keep a close eye on him. For now, I wanted to ask you about this. She showed Michelle a photo of the nightie with stars on. It's Lola's, she corrected herself. It could be hers. I mean, she had one just like it. Did your husband take Lola on holiday last summer? Michelle nodded. Yes, he took her to Wales. His cousin, the one I told you about, has a static caravan in Rhyl. So this nightie was among the things you packed for her? Only he says that's why it was still in his possession when he went to Portugal, that he forgot to unpack it. Michelle shook her head firmly. No, definitely not. I'd have remembered, because Lola Jade prefers pyjamas. Rachel and Brickle exchanged a glance. And is there anyone else, anyone at all you can think of, who might have had reason to take your daughter? Anyone with a grudge against you? Michelle appeared to be thinking about this. There was someone I fell out with once, Joanne Keane. Rachel took out her notebook. Go on. Her husband, Danny, put in the kitchen for us. Only he made a right mess of it, so we refused to pay him all the money. We paid around half, I think. Michelle picked at the polish on her fingernails, which was cracked and peeling. Anyway, there was a massive row about it. They threatened to sue and everything. Joanne got involved and picked a fight with me at the school gates. A physical fight? Asked Rachel. Michelle coloured slightly. I may have slapped her in the heat of the moment, but she gave as good as she got. It was mostly a screaming match, and when her friend dragged her away, she said she was going to get me. I remember that clear as day, her shouting, I'm going to get you, you bitch. While Rachel was playing good cop, Brickle had stood up and walked into the kitchen, opening cupboards and looking inside drawers. So, he said in his best bad cop voice, pointing to the open cupboard, do you mind telling us about this, Mrs. Harper? What do you mean? There's nothing in the cupboard apart from some sugar lumps and out-of-date instant coffee that's as hard as rock. Are you actually living here? Michelle pulled out a tissue, shaking her head.
I can't stand it, she said simply. I can't stand being alone here at night, walking past the door to my princess's room.
She gulped and blinked hard as though she was either trying to keep back tears or force them to start.
So I'm spending most of my time over at Lisa's.
Your sister? Michelle nodded. Rachel closed her notebook, which was a cue she knew Brickle would understand. Right, I think we'll leave it there. It might be helpful if you let us know where you are next time we get in touch. When they reached the car, Brickle asked, Are you thinking what I'm thinking? Rachel nodded. Time for a bit of vehicular reconnaissance. They pulled the car into a perpendicular tree named Close, positioned just out of sight, and waited until Michelle's BMW drove past, then followed at a discreet distance. She drove 3 miles due west to the Albert Park area on the far side of Eastwell, a grid of Victorian workers' brick cottages, and parked outside an unassuming flat-fronted terrace. The door was opened by a square woman with pink hair, Lisa Urquhart. Her face remained impassive as Michelle went inside, then the door was closed. We'd need to cross-check her statement on the file, but I'm pretty sure that's Lisa's address. So her story about staying at her sister's is true, said Brickle. I told you, she just can't act being alone. Given we have to look at the entire family, I still reckon we should search the place, Rachel said. Sounds like a waste of time to me. Brickle started the engine and turned the car back towards London. He caught sight of Rachel's expression. Right you are, boss. I'll apply for a warrant.
We've passed the Harper file on to our victim identification team.
Giles Denton, director of SEOP, was leading the case conference in the ground floor meeting room of the department's offices in Vauxhall Bridge Road. He was around 35, swarthily handsome in the black Irish mould, with a face shaded with stubble and eyes so dark it was almost impossible to discern that they were blue. Rachel gazed at him admiringly whenever no one else was looking. She couldn't help herself.
They'll cross-check pictures of Lola Jade with images from sites frequented by online abusers, and liaise with the victim ID community in other countries.
His North Sea blue eyes were directed at Rachel, and she looked quickly down at the cup of tea that had just been provided from a trolley wheeled in by someone in catering.
Brickle was already on biscuit number 4. So you think Lola Jade has been targeted by a paedophile ring? I think it's a strong possibility, given that there's still no body, and evidence points to her having been removed from the home alive. She fits the shopping list.
He made air quotes. She's Caucasian, blonde, under the age of 7, highly saleable in this market. Rachel screwed up her face in distaste before debriefing the team on her trip to Spain and Portugal, keeping her eyes focused on the fire drill instructions fixed to the wall rather than on Giles's stubbled jaw. We've re-interviewed Gavin Harper, without much success, I'm afraid, and we'll speak again to friends and family, but this time round try and cast the net beyond the original witness list. The hope is that a few months on, someone will remember something or mention a detail they didn't think important before. Make the passage of time work for us.
Gavin had a cousin who apparently took a keen interest in Lola and holidayed with her. We'll need to speak to him and his wife.
And I've applied for a warrant to search the aunt's house, Brickle chipped in through a mouthful of chocolate digestive. Lisa Urquhart. We know Lola's mother, Michelle, has been staying there. It's a long shot, but it could throw up some fresh forensics.
With a consensus that they would convene for an update in a week, the meeting was adjourned, and Rachel and Brickle gathered their belongings and drove back over the Thames to the Tinworth Street site in Lambeth.
A whole week, Brickle's expression was suggestive. Sure you can wait that long, Prince, for another sighting of Boy's Own. Behave!
After they had parked the pool car, they walked in through the lobby, heading up to their third floor office. Rachel's knee was stiff from sitting, and Brickle had to wait for her to catch up, with exaggerated sighs and eye-rolling.
"You go up," she told him as they reached the lift. "I'm going to go straight home and put my leg up for a bit. Oh, shit!"
The colour drained from her face. Brickle followed her gaze to the reception area, to where a man was standing. A tall, distinguished-looking man with thick sandy hair streaked with grey. Stuart Ritchie. Brickle tipped his head in the same direction.
That him?
But Rachel had already turned on her heel and ducked through the fire escape door. She headed back down the stairs to the underground car park, moving as fast as her injured leg would allow.
Hold on, you plank!
Brickle ran after her.
Let me drive you home. Jesus, what a head case! All this fuss over avoiding an ex!
Rachel turned to face him as she reached her car door.
He's not just an ex. He's my husband. You really are a puzzle wrapped inside an enigma buried in a... however the stupid saying goes.
Brickle spread himself over Rachel's sofa, not attempting to hide the smug smile of triumph that lit up his face. He had insisted on coming up to the flat with her, even though the coast was clear.
Just in case your old man's beaten us to it and is waiting outside your front door.
He wasn't, but Rachel asked Brickle in anyway, poured them both wine and opened a packet of crisps. She rarely cooked, and this was the only food she had in stock, other than salad and greens in the fridge. Brickle liked to tease her about her preoccupation with healthy eating, just as she poured scorn on his love of junk food.
Done loads with the place since last time I was here, he said sarcastically,
indicating the bare white walls, the sterile kitchen services, and general absence of clutter or personal memorabilia.
So,
he went on around a mouthful of half-chewed crisps, surprisingly still hungry after five biscuits.
You've been married all this time, and you never said a word. Quite the dark horse.
It's not what it looks like, said the criminal to the copper. Rachel reached for the pack of tramadol and swallowed one with a deep draught of wine. It was the first she'd taken all day, but after running down the steps to the basement, she needed it.
I mean, I'm legally married, but only because I haven't got round to a divorce.
Brickle put down his wine glass and stared at her.
How long have you been married? Jesus, Prince! I mean, I've known you at least 5 years, and you've never once mentioned a husband. Why the secrecy? Not like I haven't seen an endless line of men traipsing in and out of your bedroom.
She ignored this last remark. Her dysfunctional yet eventful love life was an endless source of entertainment to her detective sergeant, but she knew better than to rise to the bait. Besides, this was a subject she did not want treated with jocularity or subjected to scrutiny. It was a long time ago. I was 22, and it only lasted around a year.
He in the force?
She shook her head. Pathologist, Dr. Stuart Ritchie.
Actually, he could even be Professor Ritchie now.
Brickle calculated on his fingers.
So, if it was about 17 years ago, why the need to avoid him? Water under the bridge. You've moved on, and presumably so has he.
Rachel flushed slightly.
Because I didn't behave very well. Go on.
I was very unhappy. I suppose I was still pretty immature, and I couldn't cope with being married. So one day, without saying anything, I went home, packed up all my stuff, and ran away.
Disappeared.
This was before social media and online footprints, so he had no idea where I was. Brickle squinted at her as he drank his wine. What a little cow. But surely after the dust had settled, he'd have been able to track you down. Clearly he has, finally. Rachel sighed.
That's what I'm afraid of. I really hurt him.
She looked at her fingernails. Badly. He was distraught. I know for a fact he was, because he went to my family, pleaded with them to intervene on his behalf. But I forbade them to tell him where I was. It caused a lot of bad feeling, particularly with my sister Lindsay. Rachel sighed again. Bad feeling between Lindsay and herself had become the norm. But they did what I asked and kept silent. I hid from him for so long that eventually he gave up, and I pretended it had never happened.
But you're a big girl now, Prince. Time to come clean.
Well, he shoveled in more crisps. Arguably, that time has been and gone. She sighed. I'd buried it, all of that period in my life, and I don't want to rake over it now. Brickle was grinning. Whoever would have thought the cool, always in control D.I. Prince could do something so deviant?
And you're the only one I've ever talked to about it, so for Christ's sake, keep it zipped.
Rachel helped herself to more wine, then stuck her right leg up on the coffee table. How are things going with the lady barrister? He pulled a face. I asked her out, but she wasn't too keen. Said maybe coffee sometime, blah, blah, usual kiss-off. But she'd given you her number when you were on the trial together.
Brickle shook his head. Not exactly. In fact, since we're having a confessional session, I've got one to make.
Go on.
I used our access to DVLA records to check where she lives. Then I contrived to bump into her on her street.
Rachel froze, slopping her wine.
Mark, you know how risky that is.
Using a police database to access someone's information for personal reasons was a disciplinary offence. He shrugged.
No one's ever going to find out, and I know I can trust you, just like you can trust me, Mrs. Ritchie.
I'm not Mrs. Ritchie, never was. I've only ever called myself Rachel Prince.
He paused with his head tipped back to swallow another fistful of crisps.
Let's face it, you're just not wife material.
Chapter 10.
Not a happy bunny, is she?
Brickle jerked his head in the direction of Lisa Urquhart, who was scowling fiercely in their direction, arms across her ample chest. If her sister embodied passive aggression, then Lisa was just plain aggression.
I don't get why you need to do this, she snarled as a team of forensic officers went through the house, examining the contents of drawers, peering under furniture, climbing up into the roof space, with one of their number snapping photos of everything.
It's not like Lola Jade would be here. That's ridiculous.
Michelle herself was at work, apparently, but her lapdog Diva made her presence felt with a volley of yapping. Lisa had a husband, Kevin, and two children, Chelsea and Connor, who had been temporarily moved into a shared room so that Michelle could use the third bedroom. Rachel waited until the forensics team had finished before snapping on latex gloves and going in there herself. The single bed had a Disney cover on it and looked recently slept in. The child's dressing table was strewn with makeup and hair products and what looked like a dead tabby cat, but turned out to be a nest of stripy blonde and brown hair extensions. The wardrobe contained some of Michelle's clothes and shoes neatly arranged, and there were several skimpy lace thongs in a drawer that would have been far too small for Lisa.
"So what do we think?" asked Brickle as the search was concluded, and the forensic team stripped off their paper suits.
Diva the dog darted forwards and nipped him on the ankle. He aimed a kick in its direction.
Fuck off, you little rodent.
Well, we'll have to see what the DNA samples show up, but my gut's telling me Lola definitely hasn't been here recently.
Did we look at the husband? Brickle asked.
You mean Kevin Urquhart? Couple of minor disorder offences, brawling in a pub, that kind of thing. Our favourite. Nothing to suggest he'd be involved in snatching his own niece, but it might be worth talking to neighbours or colleagues in case. Rachel turned back and looked at the Urquhart's house. I dunno. There's something, a bell going off in the depths of my brain, but I can't think what it is. It'll come to you, Prince. It always does. Brickle unlocked the car. So, who's next on the hit list? Gavin Harper again? Is he remanded? Rachel climbed into the driver's seat, wedging her right leg awkwardly into the footwell. It still hurt intermittently, but she was learning to ignore the pain. To distract herself, she looked at her phone. Not any more, he's not. She looked up at Brickle. There's a message here from Surrey Police, saying that after his lawyer provided a prepared statement, they charged him with the passport fraud and bailed him. I don't think we're going to get anything else out of him by questioning him, but let's keep a check on his movements and talk to people who might be able to tell us more. Which means you're going to find out what you can about his cousin Tony Ingram, and I'm going to go and talk to his divorce lawyer. Howard had coaxed Rachel into practicing her dead hang again, and while she was suspended in space, he was taking a long, hard look at her body. His scrutiny made her feel self-conscious, but the warmth in her cheeks was fortunately disguised by her general sweatiness. "Your knee looks a bit better," he observed when she eventually relinquished her grip. "Less swollen." "I think it's improved a bit," Rachel agreed. "And before you say anything, I have been very moderate with the drugs. I'm only taking them when I'm desperate." Howard grinned. "Glad to hear it." He had such a nice smile, Rachel thought, and she was started to look forward to him smiling at her and experiencing a little flip at the base of her stomach when he did. A telltale sign. But he was married, and she had sworn off married men. Off men in general. It was a couple of years since she'd dated anyone semi-seriously. A solicitor called Simon. And even longer since she dated anyone seriously. Although there had been a smattering of one, two, and even three nightstands. Nobody who had held her interest for longer than that. But with Howard, there was definitely interest, curiosity even. "What does your wife do?" she asked. "She's a manager in a department store." "And how long have you been married?"
6 years.
"Kids?"
He shook his head sadly.
"I want them, she doesn't. Before we were married, she was all over the idea. She'd chosen the names and everything. Now she's done a complete U-turn, so she can't see how they'd fit into our lives."
"There'll be time for her to change her mind, though."
"Maybe. She's already 36. We've been having rows about it non-stop. That's why we went to the pub, to try and talk properly on neutral territory." He gave a rueful look. "Didn't work, though. I still ended up spending the night in the spare room."
"Get out!" Rachel wanted to tell him. "You're far too nice to be in a lousy marriage."
"Have you got time for a drink?" Howard said suddenly. "A couple of the swimming coaches are heading down to the pub in a bit."
Rachel hesitated a fraction too long. "No," she said eventually.
"Thanks, but I'd better get going. I've got a couple of things I need to follow up on."
She went home via the local Whole Foods store, picking up the makings of a salad and a bottle of organic Zinfandel. After she'd eaten, she took her glass of wine out onto her tiny balcony, enjoying the late autumn dusk. The air was cool but ripe, much like the wine. She picked up her phone and composed a text.
"Hi, Stuart."
What on earth should she say?
What could she say after 17 years of silence and effectively ruining his life?
A tendency towards conflict avoidance and emotional self-sufficiency were two of the many reasons she was still single.
Well, technically married, but with a single lifestyle.
But on this occasion, she accepted she was just going to have to face up to her failings, conflict or not. "Sorry I didn't take your calls. I've been busy at work."
She deleted the last five words and replaced them with, "I'll admit it, I was avoiding you." After she had sent the text, she flipped through her Facebook account. Danielle Patton had posted a sweet picture of Nigel with their baby Jack on his lap. The little boy was clutching a blue plush rabbit. Rachel stared at the photo for a few seconds, the familiar bell ringing in her brain. Then she dialed Brickle, who picked up after two rings.
"I've just thought of something about the Urquhart house that was bugging me."
"Go on."
"Did you notice?"
She was interrupted by a pinging on her phone as a text arrived. A glance confirmed it was from Stuart.
"Sorry, Mark, gotta go. We can talk about it in the morning."
"Rude," complained Brickle, hanging up. Rachel sat sipping her wine and looking at Stuart's text. His faintly pompous tone melted the years away, and she was once again the impressionable young WPC, fresh from Hendon Police College, working on her first murder case.
"That much was obvious. Nevertheless, I'm sure you'll agree that it's important we talk. Soon."
She sighed and typed a brief reply. "Tell me where and when." The next morning she tracked down Brickall in the NCA canteen. He was eating a fried breakfast, his favourite meal apart from pizza with hot sauce.
"So what was that about last night? I was all psyched up for the big reveal."
He shovelled mushrooms and sausages into his mouth with hedonistic abandon. Rachel had the grace to look sheepish. "My husband..."
"Demanding his conjugal rights, was he?"
Brickle winked as he squirted brown sauce over his fried eggs, then proceeded to puncture the yolks with his fork.
"Don't be ridiculous," snapped Rachel. "He thinks we should talk, and let's face it, he's probably right."
She drank some of her mug of canteen coffee, wincing at the acrid taste.
"Listen, what I was about to say was this. The early footage of the house in Willow Way shows a hideous big studio portrait of Lola on the living room wall and her favourite Katie Bear teddy in her bedroom. Michelle then takes it to the press conference, uses it as a prop to demonstrate how devoted she is."
"So?"
Brickle slathered butter on some toast. "So, when I visited her on my own, I checked, and neither of those items, those very important items, are still in 57 Willow Way. Michelle's decamped to her sister's in Jubilee Terrace, so you might expect her to take them with her. But they weren't there yesterday during the search. Not in her room, not in the loft, not in the garage."
Brickle thought about this for a moment.
"Maybe she's packed up some stuff and put it in storage, or taken it to her mum's place, doesn't want to be reminded."
"My brain says maybe." Rachel ventured another sip of the bitter coffee. "But my gut doesn't necessarily agree."
"I've got something much juicier than that anyway."
Brickle dipped the toast into the egg yolk, then swirled it through the brown sauce.
"What are you talking about? You know the cousin, Tony Ingram, the one who's so devoted to little Lola Jade?"
Rachel could tell from his tone that he was excited, even though he appeared to be concentrating on his breakfast.
"Go on." "Old Tony's on the sex offenders register for molesting a little girl."
Chapter 11. Not what I'd planned to do this morning. I was going to speak to Gavin Harper's divorce lawyers. They're in the city. Rachel checked her phone as Brickle negotiated the South Circular heading for Ruislip Gardens. No further communication from Stuart, which was a relief. Until she was actually face to face with him, she wanted no interaction at all, just to blank him from her mind. She looked out of the windscreen at the almost stationary queue of traffic.
"So I'm now on completely the wrong side of London."
"Stop bloody whining," muttered Brickle. "You know that information like this needs looking into as soon as possible. An actual paedophile connected to the missing child, even if he did only get community service."
"You're right," Rachel forced a smile. "Game face on."
The Ingrams lived in an anonymous pebbledashed end terrace house,
with net curtains and a mid-range family saloon parked on the drive. When Joyce Ingram answered the door, Rachel felt as though she'd walked onto the set of an advert for gravy or garden furniture, with Joyce being the 50-something mum of the family. She even wore an apron and wiped her hands on it as she showed them into a drab but tidy living room. "Is your husband at home?" Rachel asked, after she had introduced herself and Brickle. "No, love. He's back at work now. He's a finance clerk at Harrow Council." She indicated a framed photo of a harmless-looking grey-haired man in steel-framed glasses. "Back after sick leave." "So how long was he away from his employment?" asked Rachel, counting back rapidly. "About 5 months."
Joyce flushed slightly.
"I know what you're probably thinking. But that unpleasant business was years ago. It's over with now."
"So how are you and your husband related to the Harpers?"
"Gavin's mum, Pat, Lola Jade's gran, is Tony's first cousin. We used to look after Gavin, Andy and Karen quite a bit when they were little." She gave an awkward smile. "We couldn't have our own. We tried. Even did the IVF when it was quite a new thing."
"And you also saw a fair bit of Lola Jade?"
"A bit," conceded Joyce. "We're not exactly local, so it's only now and then. But we have a caravan in Rhyl, and Gavin used to bring Lola out there for a few days in the summer." She screwed up her mouth. "Not this year, obviously. It's just so dreadful."
"You probably understand why we need to talk to your husband," said Brickle, happily slipping into bad cop, "with him being on the sex offenders register."
"Well, we shouldn't be on it," said Joyce firmly, bright red patches appearing at the centre of her cheeks. "It was all a big misunderstanding. He was just trying to be civic-minded, helping out with the Girl Scouts camp, and look what he gets for his efforts."
Rachel and Brickle exchanged a familiar look, the well-worn wife's defence. It was all a big mistake. Joyce saw it, jutting out her chin.
"And if you're gonna ask about his whereabouts when Lola went missing, that's very easy. He was in Northwick Park Hospital, having a quadruple heart bypass. He came out of hospital at the end of May, and he's been here, and in Rhyl, recuperating until he was fit enough to go back to work a week ago."
She looked defiantly at them.
"I suppose that would be easy enough for you to verify."
"Indeed." Rachel stood up. "Thanks for your time, Mrs. Ingram."
As she headed for the door, she caught sight of a large photo in a frame. It was the prized caravan, awning out against a vivid blue sky. Joyce and Tony sat on deck chairs, both wearing shorts, and Lola Jade Harper stood on the caravan steps. Rachel picked it up.
"That was last summer. Gavin took it," said Joyce. "It's a nice one of Lola, even if she is still in her nightclothes at 10 in the morning. Gavin tended to be a bit relaxed with the rules when he was on holiday with her."
Rachel looked at the photo. For once, little Lola Jade was smiling, and it transformed her otherwise plain face. And the nightdress she was wearing was white, with coloured stars.
"Did Michelle pack Lola's clothes when she went away with her dad?" she asked, handing the photo to Brickle.
"Always," said Joyce firmly. "She was very organised about things like that. Always very inappropriate stuff, too. Frilly this and sparkly that. No rainwear or sensible shoes."
"And when Lola went home at the end of the holiday, did you pack her stuff or did Gavin?"
"Gavin did." Joyce smiled fondly. "He always left it to the last minute, then shoved everything in, all jumbled up, not folded or anything. He's a bit messy, our Gavin."
Brickle handed back the photo, and they headed back to the car.
"Well, that was interesting," said Rachel, as Brickle put the key in the ignition.
"Why, pedo Tony's out of the frame if the heart surgery checks out."
"The nightdress," said Rachel. "Michelle said she didn't pack it for the holiday, when she clearly did."
Brickle looked at her as the engine roared to life. Because her version of events makes it look as though there's something sinister about Gavin randomly having the nightie in his rucksack.
Exactly. She lied to us.
Hepburn, Willis and Bell was an undeniably upmarket firm of solicitors in Blackfriars. Their offices occupied several floors of a sleek glass tower on Victoria Embankment, with a huge ground floor reception area featuring low-level seating, state-of-the-art light fixtures and copies of Country Life. Rachel was collected by a PA in an elegant black dress and taken to see Conrad Bell, the partner who was dealing with the Harpers' divorce. He was a bony, ascetic young man with wired-framed glasses, dressed in the type of three-piece suit that Rachel's grandfather used to wear. He pointed to a chair facing his desk, revealing double cuffs and monogrammed cufflinks. "Detective Inspector Prince," he said smoothly, "how may I be of assistance, and did Camilla offer you refreshments?" Rachel began by expressing surprise that Gavin Harper wasn't using a firm of local solicitors. Bell inclined his head slightly. "Ah, yes, well, perhaps in some instances that is the most sensible thing, but this is an exceptional case that features some unusual challenges. So Mr. Harper very correctly sought representation by a firm that has expertise in children's issues." He waved his hands in an expansive manner. "Leave to remove overseas, child abduction, Kafka's reports, that sort of thing. And you're right in your assumption that we have done some preliminary work for Mr. Harper, but he is not currently instructing us."
"I see," said Rachel, weighing up the plush carpet and expensive desk, and concluding that this news wasn't exactly a surprise. Even if Gavin hadn't fled the country, you'd have to wonder how he would manage to pay for all this.
"But you'll presumably be aware that his daughter Lola Jade Harper has been missing for 5 months. I'm part of the team that's investigating her disappearance, and I need access to Gavin Harper's divorce file."
Bell leaned back, shooting his cuffs. "I am aware, yes, most unfortunate. But as a law enforcement officer, you will be aware of my duty of confidentiality to my client. Unless records are subpoenaed by a judge or a government body that has the statutory power to request them."
Rachel parried with her blandest professional smile. "Though, of course, under the 1989 Children Act, you are under a duty to reveal any expert's reports commissioned for the purposes of proceedings involving a child."
Touché, she thought.
Bell looked annoyed, but returned to the bland professional geniality.
"There is, of course, the possibility of voluntary disclosure. I could ask Mr. Harper if he's willing to let you view the papers."
"Do you have a number for him?" Rachel thought of the disconnected UK mobile and the burner phone in Portugal, now in an evidence store.
"Indeed," he parried smoothly. "My client has recently returned from a trip overseas."
"That's one way of putting it," thought Rachel, picturing Gavin Harper handcuffed to her over a plain armrest.
"And our office has recently been in touch with him, so if you'd care to wait, I could speak to him."
Rachel did care to wait, and was led into a conference room with a huge glossy table at its centre. Camilla glided in as if on wheels, bearing a tray with a cafetiere of freshly brewed coffee, a porcelain cup and saucer, and a tray of Belgian biscuits. She reappeared about 30 minutes later with a couple of thick manila folders that had Harper G.J. written on their spines.
"I may need copies of some of this,"
Rachel told her.
"Of course,"
she nodded and floated out. There were dozens of documents, and Rachel quickly realized that she would not be able to read them all unless Hepburn, Willis and Bell provided a bed for the night. She poured herself some coffee, settled into her chair, and began to read the story of Gavin and Michelle's marriage.
Chapter 12.
Rachel started by flicking through the correspondence and weeding out what she thought was most important.
First up was a lengthy report from a Dr. Marion Flugman, MB, BS, M.Psych. She had been commissioned to conduct a psychological examination of Mrs. Michelle Leslie Harper, née Kenny. The complainant, Mr. Gavin Harper, reports that his wife seemed to have a mood disorder and to be, in his opinion, unstable. She made repeated false allegations of child sex abuse with regard to their daughter Lola Jade Harper, aged 6. According to Mr. Harper, she catastrophized his late return of the child after a contact visit and made a complaint of spousal abduction, later withdrawn. He describes constant mood swings, alternating rage and coldness or withdrawal. Her relationship with her daughter is described as obsessive, with the need to have total control over the child, while at the same time treating her with emotional indifference, as though she is a trophy or a possession. Mr. Harper wonders if his wife might be suffering from undiagnosed bipolar disorder and consequently be unsuitable to have primary care of their daughter. Mrs. Harper initially refused to attend for diagnostic interview, but when it was explained to her that her refusal would be a material factor in the upcoming decision about her daughter's residence order, she complied, with marked reluctance. Method. I employed the World Health Organization's IPDE assessment, International Personality Disorder Examination, comprising a self-administered screening questionnaire and a semi-structured interview booklet with scoring materials. Findings. I was able to reject the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, where manic behavior and depression must remain consistent for at least 4 days at a time. In Michelle Harper's case, the fluctuations were more short-lived and triggered by external events, particularly the perceived failings of others. This is consistent with a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. The clinical definition of BPD is a pervasive pattern of instability of interpersonal relationships, self-image and effects, and marked impulsivity beginning by early adulthood and present in a variety of contexts, indicated by 5 or more of the 9 diagnostic criteria. My assessment concluded that Mrs. Harper demonstrates the following. 1. A pattern of unstable and intense interpersonal relationships characterized by alternating between extremes of idealization and devaluation. 2. Identity disturbance, a markedly and persistently unstable self-image. 3. Inappropriate intense anger or difficulty controlling anger, e.g. frequent displays of temper, constant anger, recurrent physical fights. 4. Transient stress-related paranoid ideation or severe dissociative symptoms. 5. Affective instability due to a marked reactivity of mood, e.g. alternating irritability and anxiety. Conclusion. There is clearly a discussion to be had regarding Mrs. Harper's ability to care for her daughter appropriately. Parents with BPD typically lack insight into their own parenting abilities and become enraged when their child does not agree with them. They also attempt to control their children's behaviours, feelings, and actions to a degree that inhibits their child's ability to develop independently. Lola's father reports the child becoming increasingly withdrawn as she constantly attempts to please her mother, who in turn believes her own behaviour is that of an exemplary parent. Rachel thought back to the photos of Lola Jade, rarely smiling, with a generally unhappy air, to Gavin's description of Michelle's parenting style. Had someone snatched Lola to get her out of her mother's clutches, or was this something else altogether? She sipped the excellent coffee and flicked through the file again. Her eye was caught by the cream and pink paper. Certified copy of an entry of birth,
Lola Jade Harriet Harper, 13th of September 2009. Attached to it with a paperclip was a copy of a second birth certificate. Oliver Jake Terence Harper, 7th of April 2008. And behind that was a third certificate. The stark black and white print stating, Certified copy of an entry pursuant to the Births and Deaths Registration Act 1953. Death. That bleak word in capitals, inside a black framed text box. Oliver Jake Harper, 2nd of July 2008. Cause of death. 1. Unascertained. 2. Ear infection. The death certificate had been signed by the Surrey County Coroner, and there was a police report and a summary of the post-mortem findings, both of which were inconclusive. The baby had been a little grizzly when he had been put down for a nap, and had been found dead by Michelle 2 hours later. Rachel thought back to the baby photos in Michelle's album and on display on the wall of her house. They were all of infants in lacy dresses and pale pink. Not a single image of a boy. Odd. At the top of the file was the bill for Conrad Bell's services and other defrayed expenses, totalling £9,875 plus VAT. Stapled to it was a red bill for the same amount, with account overdue stamped on it. So Bell had declined to move past his preliminary investigations when it looked as though he wasn't going to be paid. Camilla sashayed in to collect the tray, and Rachel gave her the documents she wanted copied, firing off a text to Brickle while she waited. We definitely need a chat with Gavin Harper. Meet you at the office? So here's an alternative theory based on the divorce case. Rachel and Brickle had repaired to the Pin and Needle, where they held a lot of their informal case conferences. And in Rachel's current predicament, it was a lot more comfortable than sitting at her desk. She could stretch out her right leg. Go on. Brickle bent his head and carefully siphoned up lager from an overfilled glass, then started on a bowl of chips. Rachel had limited herself to mineral water but stole one of the chips. Gavin Harper wants to get full custody of his daughter, so employs a top lawyer who finds a psychiatrist willing to say that Michelle is a dangerous nutter. But he runs out of money to retain said lawyer long before the case reaches the family court. So he takes matters into his own hands and runs off with Lola. Brickle squinted, his expression sceptical. But you said that apart from the nightdress, which we've cleared up, there was no sign he'd taken the kid to Portugal with him. There wasn't. At least not in Albufeira. But what if that was just a move to take us down the wrong track? What if he's actually hidden her somewhere else? According to Surrey Police, since he was bailed, he's been shacked up at his dad's. At least that's the reporting address he's given them. So we should start by visiting Terry again, and possibly Andy. He obviously knew more than he was letting on. The family are certainly not fans of Michelle. It's perfectly plausible they'd want to see Lola Jade taken away from her. Brickle shoveled in the remaining chips and drained his lager. It never ceased to amaze Rachel that not only was he not overweight, but he never seemed to gain an ounce, despite his shocking eating habits. Shall we head down to Eastwell then? He jangled his car keys in her face. She checked the time. Nearly 5 p.m. Not this evening, I'm going out. He did a mock double take. A date, Prince? She nodded. It is, as it happens. Who's the lucky man? Married, is he? Yes, to me. The restaurant Stuart had chosen was on the South Bank and boasted a Michelin star. It was a combination of the setting and her nervousness that made Rachel break with tradition and wear a dress. Her sole little black dress was short, made of heavy crepe, and trimmed with a pleated flounce that flared as she walked. She added red suede heels, wincing at the effect on her knee, and bright red lipstick. Style it out,
she told herself. Make it look as though you're in control.
Stuart stood up when she came into the dining room, and his very physical presence made her catch her breath. She was reminded of how she had felt when she first met him, how impressed she had been by his self-possession. Everything he said and did was deliberate and carefully considered, in contrast to men her own age, who had seemed chaotic and immature. He was 50 now, and had lost some of his glamorous aura, but still carried himself well. Distinguished, Rachel thought. That's what men like Stuart become. She hesitated for a long time near the maitre d' station, part of her willing herself to turn and walk out. I don't want to do this. I don't want to talk to him about that time. As she prevaricated, he turned his head and saw her, standing up and beckoning her over. He reached in for a European double-cheek kiss, as though they had last seen each other only months ago. Rachel did not return it.
Rachel, look at you. You look magnificent, and you haven't aged at all.
She looked askance at him as she sat down. That's very gallant, but not true.
Stuart smoothly summoned a waiter and pointed to something on the wine list. It's making me wonder why we didn't do this a lot sooner.
Rachel flushed slightly. I think we both know why we didn't, and that's my fault.
He smiled faintly. Well, you certainly made it as challenging as possible for me to get in touch with you. But I've kept track of your career. You're a high-flying member of Interpol.
It's part of the National Crime Agency now, but yes, I am.
Mind you, as soon as I met you, I knew you'd go far. You were so adorable, so fresh-faced with all that blonde hair pinned up under your uniform hat, but there was a fire in your eyes. The only person I could look at in that courtroom was you.
He was referring to the case of an unidentified body that Rachel had found in an alley when she was on the beat. They had both been witnesses at the subsequent coroner's inquest. His admiring tone made Rachel uncomfortable, and she pretended to examine the menu. A waitress arrived with a bottle of Poulinou Montrachet in an ice bucket and two glasses.
I think you'll love this. It's the style of white you used to go for.
Actually, I tend to drink red these days. Stuart looked suitably chastened.
Yes, well, an awful lot of water and wine has flowed under the bridge since then.
For a while they kept to more neutral topics. His work, he now held a prestigious chair in pathology at the University of Edinburgh, the weather, London property prices, but Rachel had no desire to prolong the encounter, so eventually she saw no option but to blunder straight in. So why did you get in touch?
She took a sip of the wine to calm her jangled nerves.
He was right. It was delicious. But then Stuart being right about everything had been the root of the problem, the reason she ran away. She had felt micromanaged, suffocated.
I want a divorce.
He softened this bald statement with a smile.
It's silly that we're still legally married after all this time. Time to formally sever the tie.
Rachel nodded. I can't argue with that.
I'm with someone now, in a stable relationship, and I expect she'll want to get married at some point.
She wants to, but you don't?
The waiter was hovering. Shall I order for us both? Simpler that way?
And without waiting for her response, he did so, selecting dishes that Rachel had no objection to, but wouldn't necessarily have chosen herself. Case resting, she thought. She'd spent much of the day reading the story of the Harpers' marriage, and here, in a nutshell, was the story of hers.
Stuart gave her a rueful look. Obviously, my view of marriage has been tainted somewhat. But Claire's never been married before, and she'd like to have children, so I feel I should be in a position to offer her that. Do you have children?
Rachel shook her head firmly, looking down at her lap. No.
Ever wanted them? Since we split, I mean.
Rachel created an imaginary problem with one of her shoes, reaching under the table to fiddle with it. Then launching into a treatise on the effects of wet leaves on light-coloured suede. To her relief, the waiter then arrived with the starters.
"This is delicious."
She stuck her fork into the turbot mousse, still avoiding his probing. She should have known he would not be deterred, not Stuart's style. He set down his own fork and gave her a long, steady look, the look of a disappointed parent. "So, what happened, Ray? Leaving me was one thing, but taking off and vanishing, with no contact at all, it's... well, it was just plain bizarre." He hesitated, colouring slightly, not to mention deeply upsetting. "I had no idea what I was supposed to have done, and therefore no means of making it right." She gave a half shrug and dropped her gaze to the floor, returning to scrutiny of the red suede courts. He put his fingers under her chin and tried to lift it and re-establish eye contact. She flinched. "Don't, Stuart, please." "Do you really not think I'm entitled to an explanation?" That exasperated paternal tone. "Yes, I do, but..." "So what did I do? What was it about being married to me that was so terrible you had to run off one night while I was at work?"
"It wasn't just about you. I was..."
"Rachel, please. Don't insult me with the 'it's not you, it's me' excuse. You owe me better than that." She suppressed a sigh of exasperation.
"I don't doubt that. It's just that after so many years have elapsed, it seems futile to go over it all again."
"But that's just the point," Stuart said insistently, raising his voice enough to make the other diners glance in their direction. "There is no 'again' about this. How can there be when we didn't have a single conversation about what was going through your mind?" Rachel stood up abruptly.
"I'm sorry. I just can't do this. I can't talk about it."
She flung her starched linen napkin onto the table and hurried out of the restaurant as fast as her stilettos would allow.
Chapter 13. "He's here and he's not here."
"What the fuck does that mean?" Brickell demanded. He and Rachel were once again in the tiny hallway of Terry Harper's house.
"We're not after riddles, we're after facts. And your son, who's given this as his bail address?"
"Gav's been staying with me, yes, but he's hardly ever indoors. He's spending most of his time with Andy."
"Is he working?" Rachel was aware, as she asked the question, that she couldn't remember what Gavin Harper did for a living, even though it had been mentioned on the original police file. Terry filled in the gaps for her.
"He's getting a bit of plastering work. You know, he trained as a plasterer back in the day, before he set up his own building contractor's outfit."
"That'll explain how he managed to hire the big shiny divorce lawyer," said Brickell, as they headed out to the car after checking the small single bedroom where Gavin was sleeping, and ascertaining that the contents were much the same as in the apartment in Albufeira.
"Plasterers make a bloody fortune."
"Except that he hasn't paid the lawyer," Rachel reminded him. "Hence my theory about taking the law into his own hands."
"Another little chat with young Andy next, then."
Brickell started the engine and drove back to JBH Distribution, parking at the side of the building. As he cut the ignition, Rachel made to open the passenger door, but he put a hand on her arm and restrained her.
"Hold on, Tonto. Let's try and use the element of surprise this time. We should see where he heads after he's finished at work."
"Yes, probably." Rachel sat back. "The trouble is, we don't know how long it'll be before he leaves. He could be working a late shift." The prospect of being unable to bend her knee for several more hours did not appeal.
"Come on, Prince, you know you love a good stakeout. 95% utter tedium, 5% cardiac arrest causing stress. I'll get supplies."
"No, I will," said Rachel firmly. "I need to stretch my leg." She trudged up to the parade of local shops and came back with Brickell's five a day. Crisps, biscuits, chocolate bars, sweets and cans of fizzy drinks. He was busy on his phone when she returned.
Just texting Amber.
Rachel looked blank. Amber Crowley, the hot barrister.
How did you get her number?
He tapped the side of his nose.
Please don't tell me that was another abuse of your access to personal information. Anyway, didn't she blow you out?
I lifted her number from...